listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Ever since the Human Genome Project was completed in 2003, theories of human evolution that were previously considered to be fact have begun to change shape. And as new ideas emerge, we're hearing proposals that could change our history books. New York Times science journalist Nicholas Wade lays out some of the more controversial theories in his new book called A Troublesome Inheritance, Genes, Race, and Human History. It's published by the Penguin Press. I'm very pleased it has brought Nicholas Wade back to our show. Hello.
Thank you.
You're right that our biological evolution didn't stop 50,000 years ago when humans migrated out of Africa. How much of the human genome has changed since then?
Well, from looking into the human genome as we now can do, quite substantial parts of it, about 14%, according to one estimate, show the fingerprints of natural selection.
So scientists know which genes are in that 14%?
Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. This is still a fuzzy area. For the most part, we're not sure of the gene that is responsible for the selection signal, and even when we are, we often don't know what it does.
Do any of them come from interbreeding with the Neanderthals? Because we've been hearing a lot about that recently.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about that. It may turn out to be correct, but there is a definite gap between what the population geneticists tell us and what the archaeologists tell us. Mm. So in the archaeological record, there is no place and time where Neanderthals and modern humans came together, so far as we know. You have to remember, it's not in Europe that this admixture took place, according to the population geneticists. It's way earlier, like about 80,000 years ago. So we were still bottled up in Africa as a tropical species, and the Neanderthals are a cold-adapted species, so I find it hard to imagine a scenario where they came together.
You describe our basic social behaviors as the foundation of our existence as a species. What are they?
Well, I think we have a large number of ingrained social instincts. This is slightly controversial because when Ed Wilson said this in his sociobiology book, he was roundly attacked by people who thought the mind is a blank slate with nothing there when you're born.
Well, don't most people believe that there is a mix of nature and nurture?
Well, of course, it's a mix. But there is the nature there, and you need that to make us a social species. So I think there are lots of instincts, you know, particularly one to belong to a group, to obey its rules, to punish violators, all of which are quite sort of deeply ingrained in our psyches.
Well, you list behaviors like morality, trust, cooperation. How much of those things do we share with our closest primate neighbors?
Well, with chimpanzees, according to Franz De Waal, who studied them closely, we share quite a lot. We share a sort of a sense of fairness and reciprocity, a sense of sort of hierarchy and obeying rules. And maybe chimps have a very primitive morality, but that's sort of much harder to judge.
Although now we've been hearing about the possibilities that elephants, dolphins, whales, all sorts of other mammals have sense of community and cooperation and empathy.
That's right.
You write that our social institutions are based on genetically influenced behavior, the expression of which is shaped by culture. So we have this inborn ability, and then culture determines how it is enacted?
Yes. The major institutions of our society are all cultural, but if you dig down deep, you'll find some instinctual behavior on which it's based. So if you look at our military behavior, to sacrifice one's life in battle is a supremely irrational act. So why do people do it? Well, there are lots of cultural reasons in sort of training a soldier, but deep down there is this innate instinct to defend one's group, one's family.
What about language? I'm assuming that all of the genetic tools for language were there way before language developed.
I think there must have been. And the origin of language is one of the most fascinating questions. Did it develop from music or dance? Or
Well, so there are languages that are clicks and all sorts of and whistles and all sorts of other things that probably were the earliest languages.
Yes, I think you can make a good argument that clicks must have been in the earliest language because they're easily lost. And it's so hard to acquire them. So we must have started out with clicks, and everyone except for the click speakers must have gradually lost them. To do a double click is very difficult. Mm.
Now, I've developed a single click, but not the double click. Well, where does Noam Chomsky come into all of this, where he says that we have an innate ability to learn a language, whatever culture we are born into?
Right, so his idea is that there's what he calls a universal grammar. So there must be some neural system that has the general rules of grammar programmed into it. But then the entire content of language you learn from your culture. And that seems a reasonable idea to me. Language is so complicated. How can you expect a baby to sort of intuit it from its surroundings? It must have something there to help it master this ability.
Do you think that there is a genetic link to the inclination to religion?
Yes, I do. My last book, The Faith Instinct, argued that we do have an instinct for religion that was favored by natural selection, largely because it was a wonderfully cohesive force. So if groups that had religion sort of hung together better and were better equipped to survive against those that didn't.
Well, of course, religion also comes out of the desire to try to understand what's going on. If there's lightning, you could have a lightning god. And, if people act in certain ways, you can say, well, the gods acted that way, and we're just doing what the gods have told us to do.
Well, that's right. I mean, in its early days, religion did so much for us. I mean, it was our physics and biology because we didn't have any other explanatory system.
My guest is Nicholas Wade. His latest book, A Troublesome Inheritance, Genes, Race, and Human History, is published by the Penguin Press. When humans left Africa, what were the first major population splits?
Well, that was the major population split between Africans and non-Africans. And the ones who got out seemed to have been very small in number, maybe just a single tribal band. That was the first split, and then which occurred about 50,000 years ago.
And then evolutionary changes developed as a result of the environments that these various groups were now encountering?
Yes, because one has to think of evolution as a sort of dynamic force. It never stops. And the species is always trying to speciate into different subspecies. So the only way you can stop that happening is if you have a single pool, which everyone draws into, i.e. sort of total mixing into marriage. So as soon as you have a split in a population, from that point onwards, the two populations are going to continue evolving, but independently. And so this is the beginning of human races, these major splits in migration as we went around the world.
Well, how genetically different are human races? In the end, a person from one race, an Inuit, will have a child with an Australian Aborigine. So even though they have been separated for millions of years, or at least many thousands of years?
Right. Well, that's because we are still a single species, so we can interbreed with no difficulty whatever. When you say how different are we, it's a difficult question to answer because there's no sort of metric for sort of measuring genetic variation. But I think you can say to start with, we know from looking into the genome that every human on the planet has the same set of genes.
So there's a difference between phenotypes and genotypes?
Yes, the phenotype is the is what is the product of reading out the genotypic program.
So that's how we recognize one group as different from another group.
Yes, by their
skin color and things like that.
That's how the man in the street recognizes people as different, and the geneticists do so, as you implied, at the genotypic level.
And would they would we, by looking at the genes, have a pretty good idea of what racial group somebody is from?
Yes, you can do that. You look at particular sites on the genome that tend to vary a lot between races. These are called ancestral informative markers. And you scan the genome and you can assign people very accurately to the race that they say they belong to.
Now, do we have any idea of why different skin colors develop?
Yes, we do. That's one of the sort of few genetic systems we understand reasonably well. So there's a particular gene, MRCA1, if I remember it, that keeps the skin dark if you live in Africa. Dark skin is our default human skin color. But then when we started to live at high northern latitudes, you need to lighten the skin to let in sunlight to make vitamin D. So both the Caucasians and the East Asians, Caucasians being people who live in the left half of the Eurasian continent, Europeans, Indians, Middle Easterners, both those two groups develop pale skin, but through entirely different genetic mechanisms.
But then they also share certain oddities. For example, the epicanthic fold, which is common throughout most of Asia. You also find it in some Scandinavians.
Oh, I didn't know that, but I'm not surprised. And this is the way race works. It's a sort of category of very fuzzy boundaries, and there's no one criteria that puts you in a certain race. It's a cluster of criteria.
We have any idea why the epicanthic fold developed?
The only theory I know is that it's an adaptation for living in northern latitudes. So you put a fold of fat over the eye that helps insulate it, and you also have narrow nostrils.
So during the Ice Age, that protected the eye from winds that were coming from the side?
Yes.
Now, why didn't people in South America who live on the equator develop darker skins?
Probably because they haven't had time to do so. I mean, you can certainly, if you look at Europe, you can certainly see a gradient of skin color from Europeans who are very pale at the north to darker at the south. Now, I don't know whether that's just from tanning or whatever, but evolution will certainly give you dark or light skin if it really needs to, if there's a strong enough selective pressure.
There are all sorts of oddities. For example, people tend to have, men tend to be hairier in the Mediterranean, have less hair in northern climes, and less hair in the southern climes.
Hair distribution is a fascinating subject about which I know little.
Are our genetic differences enough to create subspecies, as we tend to do with other animals like dogs, cats?
Well, yes. What we call races really are subspecies. It's just that the word sub has a bad connotation, so it's preferable to say races. But it sort of means very much the same thing. And there's a debate among geneticists as to whether the variation among human groups is big enough to count as a subspecies. And some say yes and some say no.
My guest is Nicholas Wade, who is currently, well, he was deputy editor for Nature magazine and then Science magazine and now at the New York Times. His latest book, A Troublesome Inheritance, Genes, Race, and Human History, published by the Penguin Press. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Nicholas Wade, whose latest book is A Troublesome Inheritance, Genes, Race, and Human History. It's published by the Penguin Press. Humans began to settle down and give up their nomadic ways of life around 15,000 years ago on the whole. Did that happen for all races around the world around the same time? I mean, there are still nomadic peoples, but did it tend to happen everywhere?
No, it happened at different times. And that's one of the reasons why I think one can perceive a genetic influence there. After all, modern humans first appear on the scene 200,000 years ago, and it took us 185,000 years ago to be able to settle down. So you would think, well, what took us so long? It seems so obviously desirable to put a roof over your head and be able to sort of own more than you can just carry. And I think the reason it took so long was that a change in social behavior was required. People had to become less aggressive, more willing to settle down in groups, get on with people who they're not immediately related to. And so since all the various races on each continent are evolving now independently, you know, it's not surprising that they made this pivotal transition at slightly different time, because this is an example of independent evolution. So 15,000 years ago is the first settlements in Europe, followed shortly after by those in China and a bit later by those in Africa.
Well, it's interesting to look at a country like China and see how many variations there are. When did Tibetans start developing adaptations to living on much higher altitudes?
Oh, that's one of the most recent pieces of human evolution we've been able to nail down. So it was about 3,000 years ago was the time when Tibetans developed at least one of their crucial high-altitude adaptations.
Well, I was taught that evolution takes thousands of years, but you cite studies that look at changes just over a couple of hundred years.
Yes, it's amazing. I mean, these are what you call microevolutionary changes. But it does seem, particularly from looking into the genome, when we see this vast amount of very recent evidence of natural selection, that natural selection has been working in our populations very steadily ever since we left Africa, and of course before. It's a continuous process.
What did Gregory Clark find when he looked at the 600 years leading up to the Industrial Revolution?
Well, he's come up with a wonderfully new and fresh explanation of the Industrial Revolution, which is the major event in economic history, but economic historians have never agreed on any one cause for it. Clark said, well, it's a change in the nature of the people. At the beginning of the period, 1200, you had a violent peasant population, and at the end of it, 1800, you had a sort of disciplined workforce that was much more productive.
Although we still have a lot of violence, we have found newer and better ways to kill each other over the last couple of hundred years.
That's true. Our weapons have grown more and more appalling. On the other hand, I think our instinct, our proclivity for violence has got a lot less. This is what Steve Pinker argues in his wonderful book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. There's just a steady decline in violence. However horrible we are now, we were much more horrible in the distant past.
Nietzsche believed that we would evolve into supermen because we just keep on evolving. That most people don't believe that, but it turns out we are still evolving, aren't we? Although maybe not into something better.
We're evolving very fast. You know, the fact that many people have to have their wisdom teeth out is because our skulls and particularly our jaws are shrinking, so there's not room enough for all the wisdom teeth that are programmed into us.
Do we have any idea why they're shrinking? Because we're not eating raw meat or something like that?
There are certainly lots of theories related to nutrition, but the theory I favor is that there is a gracilization of our skull as we become less fierce and aggressive towards each other. This is just what you see in domestic animals. If you compare a domestic cow or sheep or pig to its wild ancestor, you can see all the bones have become lighter as they become tamer. And this is what's happened to us. We've tamed ourselves. Our most aggressive members have been sort of exiled or thrust out and survive less well.
What's an allele of a gene, and what does it tell us about racial differences?
Well, every gene comes in a variety of alternative flavors, slight differences in the DNA sequence. So in a population, you may have sort of 1 or 20 or 200 different flavors. And this is why we differ as individuals, because we have inherit a slightly different sort of set of alleles from our parents.
But we also all have the same genes that tell us that we have to have eyes and nose and mouth, and then the variations start there?
Yes, exactly. And to your question as to how does this separate races, the answer is it doesn't. Races not only have exactly the same set of genes, but also you cannot separate them by alleles. You can't point to any race and say, because of this one allele, this is what defines the race.
Now, anthropologists and sociologists call race a cultural and social construct. But you argue, don't you, that race is a biological reality?
Yes. I mean, of course it has social connotations as well. But it clearly has a basis in biology. And social scientists have reached this position, I think, for historical reasons. It was a campaign by an anthropologist called Ashley Montagu, who was very active in the 1950s, and he felt he could abolish racism and imperialism and colonialism if he could persuade people race had no biological basis. So social scientists sort of signed on to that position, and after all, it was, you know, the memory of the Holocaust was sort of fresh. We hadn't won the battle for civil rights. It just seemed another weapon in the arsenal, and they've become wedded to it past the time when it's become scientifically invalid, in my view.
Also a reaction to eugenics?
Yes, too. And that's another reason why we sort of fear looking into this sort of black box of the genome, lest it is encourage more eugenic fantasies. But we are capable of learning something from the past. And it seems to me we're very unlikely to retrace that particular footstep.
My guest is Nicholas Wade. His book, A Troublesome Inheritance, Genes, Race, and Human History. It is published by the Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, all of this grows out of Charles Darwin's theories. And right now, the whole idea of survival of the fittest is being challenged as well. There are all sorts of other possibilities for how evolutionary things occur. But at the time, people resisted even the notion that there was evolution. Have we done full swing to, except with some American politicians, to the totally opposite approach?
No, Darwin's theory has always been immensely difficult for people to accept, and we're always trying to carve out exemptions to it. So it started with religious groups saying, well, we don't believe in Darwin, and it seems to me many sociologists behave as if the theory of evolution had no relevance to their studies. People are just very unwilling to accept that we exist within the framework of our genes.
Well, if there's evidence, is there evidence of a correlation between IQ and things like wealth or race?
Well, I hate to get into IQ because I think it's been vastly overemphasized in the past, at least from the perspective that I'm looking at, which is how societies evolve. There are good correlations within societies between IQ and wealth. I think where we get into difficulty is trying to compare IQ across different populations.
Well, you write about 1927 case Buck versus Bell, which appeared before the Supreme Court. What do we learn from that?
Well, that was a dark episode in our history, I think, where the Supreme Court essentially endorsed eugenics for very bad reasons.
In the majority opinion, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, who many people remember as one of the great justices, wrote, "It is better for all the world if, instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind." And that led to the sterilization of a lot of people, some of whom didn't even fit the category that Holmes was talking about.
Right, and this is a terrible lesson for us. And it was linked to events in England and in of course in Germany. Historically, all one can say is that at least in the United States and Britain, people pulled back from eugenics. So around the 1930s, it fell out of fashion as people realized that it was just the wrong track. Unfortunately, in Germany, it did not.
Well, by 1930, 24 states had laws permitting sterilization. By 1940, over 35,000 Americans had been sterilized.
Right.
But Hitler, of course, really embraced eugenics. Do we link eugenics and social Darwinism? Are they pretty much the same thing?
I think historians would separate them because social Darwinism reached its sort of peak at the turn of the century, and eugenics was developed later.
And during the Nuremberg trials, didn't some Germans quote the Buck versus Bell decision as justification?
I'm sure they did because they were watching very carefully what was happening in the United States, and they referenced the U.S. eugenics laws in support of their own actions.
You devote an entire chapter to Jewish adaptations. What about their genetic history requires that kind of attention?
Well, I think what requires attention is the extraordinary contributions that Jews have made to our civilization. I mean, the easiest metric is in Nobel Prizes, where Jews, I think, are 0.2% of the global population, but they've won 30% of Nobel Prizes so far in this century. So there's something there that requires explanation. So if this was just cultural, like, you know, hectoring mothers or a zeal for education, you would think it'd be easy enough for other people to copy, but evidently it's not. So therefore, it seems permissible to ask if there may be a genetic explanation.
On the other hand, more Jews excelled in the universities in the past than today. Some people say it's because of assimilation. And we're now seeing Asians sort of filling the same kind of role that Jews did 30 or 40 years ago.
Well, certainly there's the phenomenon of immigrants doing sort of very well in a new country. But I think we can say that Jewish history is sort of consistent in having thrown out people of outstanding intellectual abilities.
And are we saying that's because Jewish population has been fairly isolated over the years?
Well, you have to establish, for any kind of natural selection favoring intelligence, say, to take place, you need to have the population fairly isolated, whether it's on an island or speaking a different language or, in this case, by religion, in order for any favored genes not to be just sort of washed out and diluted. So we do know quite a lot about Jewish genetics now. One may hesitate because of past abuses to say Jews are any different from anyone else, but it's largely through population geneticists who happen themselves to be Jewish and are fascinated to know what the genome can tell them about their heritage that we can say Jews, Ashkenazis, have been reasonably isolated from the European population since AD 900 when they first appear on the scene. There has been admixture, but it's a very slow rate, and it's now just sort of 5% according to one calculation.
Well, there was a study done by researchers at the University of Utah. I assume they were Mormons.
Oh, no, that study, Harpenden and Cochrane, I don't think they're Mormons, no.
The first half of this book is based on fact, and you state that the second half is speculation from evidence not supported by hard scientific proof. Was it difficult to lay out these controversial theories, knowing that you didn't have hard evidence and that people were going to be rather critical?
Yes, it was very difficult. But I wanted to break the ice because it seemed to me, having written about the genome for the last 10 years or so, that there was a great lack of interpretation of it, that there was a sort of a silence, and I needed to write a sort of missing manual as to what might be in there.
Well, are you arguing that academics and policymakers are wary of coming to certain conclusions because of fears that they would be promoting racism?
That's certainly a very vivid fear, and I think it's larger than it needs to be. I don't see there's anything in the genome that would promote racism in any way, and therefore I wish we could separate the politics from the science and say racism is wrong as a matter of principle, not of science.
But you got a pretty nice review in the Wall Street Journal from Charles Murray, who has said that there are genetic differences between the races, and that's led to the reason that whites have tended to do better in our society rather than cultural reasons. He said in his review, the Orthodoxy's clerisy will ransack these chapters for material to accuse Mr. Wade of racism, pseudoscience, reliance on tainted sources, incompetence, and evil intent.
Well, I very much hope his prediction is untrue. I mean, I much appreciated his review. What I hope is that I'm pushing on an open door, because the two basic themes of the book, that race has a biological basis and that evolution has carried on up to the present time, are both such obvious truths, it seems to me, that if only people could understand they don't lead anywhere bad, we'd be much better off.
Well, how would they be applied by policymakers?
I don't think there is.
Because there are attempts to do all sorts of things. Head Start, for example, all sorts of other things to get past the inequities that we've had in the past. But if genes are playing a role in all of this, then what kind of policies could we put in place?
Well, I think it's important to understand the difference between the genes that determine our skin color that we can't do much about and that are or should be of no importance anyway, and the genes that influence our behavior. And the ones that influence our behavior don't determine anything we do. They just sort of nudge us in one direction or another. And anyone with stereotype behavior in our society wouldn't be very successful. Our behavior is very flexible, including that part that is influenced by the genes. So genetic does not mean immutable where behavior is concerned. So I think it would be only to the good if we understood what part of our behavior had a genetic component, because then we could focus our efforts, or to the extent it might be relevant, on the remedial efforts that would reduce inequities.
Nicholas Wade's latest book is A Troublesome Inheritance, Genes, Race, and Human History. It's published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thanks so much.